It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says pretty sirens don't go flat. I'm Joe McCormick.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And our regular host, Jonathan Strickland, is not with us today. He is being bored out of his mind on vacation. But instead, we're being joined by our wonderful colleague and peer, Holly Fry. Introduce yourself, Holly.
Hi, hi, hi. I'm Holly Fry, normally from Stuff You Missed in History Class.
An excellent podcast that if you don't already listen to, you should check out.
Yeah, definitely. And Holly has been on the show before at some point. A long time ago, I believe.
Holly was with us, I think, to talk about gamifying fitness, right?
Yes.
Oh, hey.
So that was like October 2013.
Yeah. Wow,
we've been doing this a while.
And that kind of ties into our topic for today, which is fashion. The fashion of the future. The future of fashion.
Specifically, we want to talk about whether in the future there will be literal fashion police armed with shock sticks and jetpacks to chase down offenders who wear plaid jumpsuits. I don't know.
There won't be.
No.
No.
Well, we can settle that.
You know, Joan is gone, so the fashion police have all but disbanded.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Come along. It'll be fun. The fashion police used to be a show that Joan Rivers headed up where she would basically do that verbally, which was described.
Yeah.
Just chase down strangers.
And then when she passed, Kathy Griffin replaced her briefly, but then didn't really like the tone of the show because there was some, you know, it's a little judgy and negative.
It's
so she kind of took a hike. Mm-hmm. So now it's kind of in a floundering. And if anybody were going to start that branch of, legal, actual chase you down and hurt you for your poor choices, it would have been Joan Rivers.
It would have.
Since she's not with us anymore.
Although I have hope that, like, her brain is resting in a jar somewhere Futurama style, and
right?
that her robot army will descend upon our dystopian future. Or utopian future, really. I think that that would work pretty well.
Though I imagine, Holly, you'd be a great defense counsel in the court of the fashion police.
Probably, because yeah. I'm down for anything.
Right. So we actually do want to talk about fashion today. Maybe not fashion police, but just more broadly, the future of fashion. And we've talked about the future of clothing before.
Yeah. In December of 2013, we talked about stuff like kinetic fabrics and 3D printing of pieces and self-cleaning fabrics and odor filtering fabrics for all of your farts and other stuff like that.
Well, today we brought Holly on because Holly actually does have a wonderfully interesting sense of fashion, and she designs things.
I do. I mean, I like clothes. I always have since I was a kiddo. Like, I don't remember not ever being into clothes and not making them.
Yeah, yeah. And you make a lot of your own clothes, right?
I do. Most of the, unless it's a T-shirt, it's a pretty safe bet that I made it.
Except you make, like, really interesting clothes, not like the boring stuff I wear. Like, you make, like, things for like, sci-fi conventions and stuff.
I do, but I also make most of my day wear.
Yeah.
And part of that is because I never, even as a kid, liked what the offerings were off the rack. Like, I didn't like wearing the same thing as other people, and... Mm-hmm.
It didn't have enough Greedo on it, probably.
Nothing ever has enough Greedo on it for
Holly,
me.
Holly, do you have a Greedo tattoo? Does the world know this?
I do, and the world knows, and the world will know more. We have a video coming out soonish about me getting my Greedo tattoo, which will be on the How Stuff Works YouTube channel. But, yeah, I always was into kind of that crazy, a lot of film-inspired stuff and wanted to integrate that into my daily wear, so that's how I ended up kind of.
Well, that's definitely where my brain immediately goes when I think about the future of fashion. I just start thinking about, okay, sci-fi movies mm-hmm. set in the future. What are people wearing them? And immediately the first thing I think of is The Fifth Element. I'm not sure why. That is the movie screams future clothing.
It was designed by Jean-Paul Gaultier, and
yeah,
it was beautiful.
Who
is that? I'm sorry.
You're dead to me, Joe.
I hate to affirm stereotypes and be the guy in the room who doesn't know anything about fashion, but I don't.
Well, we should also say that Jean-Paul Gaultier was not the only designer on it. Mobius also designed a lot of the pieces in it.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. But Jean-Paul Gaultier is a very well-known French designer, as you might guess from the moniker. He does, if you remember, this is a ways back for some of our younger listeners, though I'm sure they've seen them. They're iconic. Madonna's tour where she did all the cone bras and those crazy corsets in the 80s, that was all Gaultier.
That's the future.
It was then.
Yeah.
Now, you know, those are just de rigueur, so.
Yeah.
I mean, that is one vision of the future. To me, The Fifth Element is interesting because it's got these sort of like wild, very eye-catching and busy kind of fashion pieces, bright colors, strange patterns, things we're not used to. But then some depictions of the future sort of go in the totally opposite direction, right? Like you've got Star Trek and things like that where they just say, well, in the future, nobody's going to care about fashion and it's all just going to be identical jumpsuits or, you know, basic gray fatigues.
Well, but you're thinking about Star Trek in terms of the uniforms.
Yeah.
Because if you look at anybody else that gets on that ship or any of the various alien cultures they encounter.
Although it seems like they default to jumpsuits and muumuu.
Well, that's true.
That's
in a lot
very
of cases,
good point, Holly.
But yeah, you have to remember that they're technically like a military crew.
Okay,
or a military is maybe not the right way to place it, but they're you know, an exploration. They're a governmental agency, basically exploring space. So it's all uniform based,
right? I mean, if you're part of an organization like Starfleet, organizations like that, past, present, and future, are always going to want to destroy your individuality and make you an identical peg.
That's one way to look at it. I look at it as simplifying and codifying, you know. You have to make it easy to identify who's who. And if you're allowed
in
to wear
emergency,
whatever you want, you won't know who the science officers are.
Oh, yeah.
Chaos. Science, chaos.
Right?
You won't know which of the away party should die on the planet.
Exactly.
Because they won't be wearing the red shirts.
Exactly.
Right, right. I mean, I'm personally really voting for, like, the golden age sci-fi 1950s version of future fashion, wherein all dudes wear, like, deep ocean diving suits and all ladies wear like bikinis that are covered in vacuum sealed plastic wrap.
I want lots of rings. I want ring collars everywhere.
Yeah.
I want it to be very Metropolis.
Uh-huh. Ooh.
And a little bit of, do you remember when Futurama went to the bar where the rings were all the thing in terms of accessories?
Mm-hmm.
And Fry was like, ooh, futuristic. And they're like, no, this is retro. So I'm into that. I dig it. Pigs in space. Fashion
Pigs
forward.
Pigs in space. Yeah.
Well, you bring up an interesting thing there, Holly, with retro and future sort of colliding, because a lot of people do seem to have observed that fashion goes in cycles, right?
Yes. There is some argument over the length of the cycle. But yeah, for the most part, you'll hear people bandy about like the 20-year cycle. There was an article recently, I'm kind of pulling this one out of memory, on Slate, where they actually talked about a New Yorker article that discussed a 40-year nostalgia cycle, and that was in reference to Mad Men and sort of how that has all happened.
Wow. Sure.
But they were using that juxtaposed against predictions and social observations of others, other sociologists and predictors that would say there was a cycle, but they all gave them different year denominations. Like, oh, no, it's a 30-year cycle. Oh. No, 15 is really where the cycle – no, 25 is more where the cycle is. So,
well, huh. But either way, it's easily observable in the fact that a lot of the things a lot of the things that the young hip kids these days are wearing seem very similar to what was popular in, like, hip-hop culture in the mid-1990s.
Right. And that does happen. There is an argument going on right now that the cycle is getting shortened by the, you know, sort of permutation of technology in our lives
and the
rapidity with which we share information now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, part of the 20-year cycle was, like, the big cities is where the retro stuff would start, and then it would slowly ripple out to more and more rural areas until it became kind of ubiquitous.
But now
everybody's attached
to
everything at the same time. So
interesting.
That happened is interesting. But what I wanted to bring up was Laver's Law. He was a historian, among other things, and a journalist, and he sort of observed and wrote down this sort of the cyclical nature of it, and he broke it out into years. So his sort of the way that he says the fashion timeline goes is that an item is considered indecent 10 years before its time, shameless 5 years before its time, daring 1 year before its time, smart when it's au courant, and that's smart in the sense of snappy, not intellect.
Okay.
I'm like, ooh, she's a smart dresser.
Yeah.
Dowdy 1 year after its time.
Huh.
Hideous 10 years after its time.
Okay.
Ridiculous 20 years after its time. Amusing 30 years after its time. Quaint 50 years after its time. Charming 70 years after its time. Romantic 100 years after its time. And beautiful 150 years after its time.
Oh, that's kind of a long, I don't know if that's even a cycle. That's just sort of like a qualitative spectrum emerging from the present year.
Yeah. And I had mentioned to Joe a little bit ago, and I did not put it in the notes because I had a revelatory moment while I was driving into work this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was thinking about this and I was trying to kind of retroactively apply these rules and be like, well, like 150 years ago, we were kind of at one of those shifts in Victorian fashion when the bustle skirt was very big. And I was like, well, that's never going to come back. And then my brain went, Nicki Minaj. And I was like, oh, it did come back.
No. Oh, yes.
And now people are getting, you know, derriere implants.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
man.
That they can make the badonk a little larger and more sumptuous. And it's basically a modernized version of a, you know, like
of
a bustle pad.
Yeah, that was the point of bustles. Yeah.
Really? Was the point of the crinolines? I thought it was like so people
don't. Well, crinolines and bustles are not the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. So the big dresses and big skirts, I always thought, and I could totally be wrong, that the point was that nobody's going to see the shape of your leg moving the dress that way. No.
There are a lot of different reasons. You can't really break it down to one. Like, for example, when you look at sort of the wide panier of, like, the Rococo period, like, so think of a Marie Antoinette dress in those really, really exaggerated hip shapes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Like you can't fit through a doorway unless you turn sideways.
Right.
Kind of thing. Right.
And that was
like the 6 foot diameter.
Right. So part of that is, one, did you know there were often little pocket cages in there?
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
Where you could, there were little
keep
pockets that you could have, which were actually just like a pocket that you would tie around your waist over your, usually over your
corsetry.
I was going to say your chemise and then your corset layer. Mm-hmm. But they also had some that were like the cage itself made a little pocket that you could literally shove a bottle of wine
put
in.
Your,
like
put your
sizable.
R2 unit in.
You not quite big enough for an astromech, but, you know, sizable. And part of that is, you know, those big extreme shapes are kind of about creating a silhouette that is fantastical and and not practical.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's part of going, I'm so rich.
Yeah, it's part of wearing your wealth.
I don't need to hustle through a door, y'all.
Sure, sure. And also being able to say, look at how much silk I can afford.
Correct.
And how much embroidery.
Wow. Yeah. So do you think we're going back into an age of, like, large, ostentatious kind of clothing pieces?
No.
No?
Because I don't think it's practical in today's world.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it could be more practical then because there wasn't as much hustle and bustle to life. Whereas now, even if you are theoretically the idle rich, you probably still have a lot of things you have to get to and do and, you know, planes you have to fit onto, and it's not quite the same.
Aside from, like, on the red carpet, especially at the Met fashion show every
year. Yeah, there are moments of that. But in terms of, like, general
day wear or even evening wear.
Not so much. But that's part of the cycle, is that things come out as haute couture first, and then they slowly get kind of a little watered down and adapted. Like, many years before the blingy jeans became popular, like, if you look about 5 years before that, Jean-Paul Gaultier was doing what, I will never forget, Alan Cumming covered one of his shows for some magazine, and he kept calling them, like, chandelier pants.
Oh.
But they were basically these jeans that were just dripping with bejewelment and beaded fringe and stuff. And then it's like, if you look just a few years later, we got to that point where we were, in fact, getting a lot of rhinestone accessorized jeans and kind of, you know, more of that sparkly thing. But it starts hard in the haute couture arena, and then it kind of slowly comes down.
Well, I thought we should try a little fashion experiment to see exactly how true Laver's Law was to at least our experience and what we can see on the internet. So I pulled up. I thought we should just look at some Google image search results for so let's start with 2014 fashion. So Laver's Law says 2014 fashion to us now should be dowdy. What do we see when we look at 2014 fashion?
I don't think it's especially dowdy.
I would not classify most of this as dowdy, no. We're seeing essentially,
I see a lot of tall women.
Well, that's not what we're actually analyzing. Next year, short people are going to be in. That's who's going to be modeling. But these tall gals are looking really.
I mean, what's actually striking me right now is that this a lot of the photographs are things that have dropped into common fashion in much the way that Holly was just discussing.
Like what?
This nice see-through dress. No, a lot of the A-line skirts and the kind of bright colors and patterns, moving away from the color block that was popular in, say, 2013 and into the sort of busy pattern that's popular today.
Yeah, a lot of tribal patterns, which, you know, periodically those will crop up in fashion. But it seems like those are getting more adopted into, I mean, you can go to your local mall,
department store,
Nordstrom, or even like a Target, and you'll see things that really echo this stuff.
Okay. Here's a thing I just noticed. When I type in something like 2005 fashion, pretty much all the results are women. So does this just not even give us a window into what men's fashion looks like in any given time? And does men's fashion change less?
It depends. I mean, I hate to keep invoking Gaultier, but
yeah.
He does some amazing menswear that is very, very outside of the norm.
Yeah.
And changes a lot.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of those designers that does a lot of dresses for men. He does a lot of, like, split leg clothing for men that kind of are cut like a gown would be, except they're pants.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty egalitarian in who gets what styles in terms of his menswear line and his womenswear line.
You know, how gender informs fashion might be something that's worth talking about in the future of fashion, because I can totally see societal attitudes about gender changing the way we have expectations for what men and women should wear.
Yes.
But let's look at least one more, because Laver's Law says that 1995 fashion should be ridiculous.
It probably will be, but I love a little ridiculous.
Huh, I expected to see more plaid. I'm not seeing plaid.
not in the high fashion range, no. But, oh, man, here's in fact, some of that.
There's a poster for Empire Records.
Yep.
Oh, and Clueless, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did 1995 fashion look like? Explain this to me. I don't know what I'm seeing.
You know, I kind of look at the mid-90s in terms of fashion as a big old mess. Like I always have, because we were coming off the popularity of grunge and that whole surge mm-hmm. where people were like, no, dress up, forget that, dress down, get really sloppy, and sloppy is where it's at, and mm-hmm. super relaxed shows how, you know, cool I am. But there were still people going, no, let's make a pretty frock. Come on, let's get this together.
Yeah, and there was also that influence of the very wear your wealth hip-hop culture,
yes.
Segment of hip-hop culture that was becoming very prevalent and even crossing over into some of the grunge wear, the way that we're seeing in some of these images of the crop tops and the miniskirts that were also influenced by the mod movement of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. There's a really groovy dress in these results with some beautiful optical illusion on it that I'm...
Ooh.
We need those.
Okay, let's look at one more before we move on to the future. The past of 1915 fashion. Now, according to Laver's Law, 1915 fashion should be romantic. And what I assume Laver means by that is not like, you know, oh, we're going out on a date romantic, but as in, like, it's a romantic notion, having, like, high emotions and...
Right. We romanticize its place in the cultural landscape.
Yes.
Sure. I don't know. I would go out on a date with some of these hats for sure.
Well, you've also stumbled into the period of one of my favorite designers of all time, Paul Poiret, who just did wild and beautiful things.
Mm-hmm. He was the one who designed... if you guys watch Downton Abbey, those beautiful harem pants that the youngest daughter got in a little bit of scandal for wearing, correct?
Yes. He is a fascinating gent. We did a podcast on him on Mist in History at one point, and one of the cool things that he did was he was sort of one of the first designers who understood branding. Like, he also put out, like, in addition to clothing lines, like, he had a little school that produced its own art pieces and its own stationery pieces, and they were branded Poiret, and he just had he would also have parties where if the ladies weren't dressed properly, he would dress them before they could come in.
Wow. That sounds nice.
Both awful and amazing. Like, I would have gone to all of those parties. Yeah. So what was going on in 1915? A lot of these clothes are historically interesting because during that period we were in the middle of World War I, so a lot of fabrics and styles were becoming more streamlined and simple, I think, as people kind of tightened their belts, literally and figuratively. And also we were in the middle of the women's suffragette movement and moving away from the giant corsets and giant bustles and restrictive skirts and all of that thing into something a little bit more movable and breathable.
Yes, giggles.
No, that sounds very insightful. All I'm seeing is ankle length everything.
Well, yeah.
So all dresses are ankle length and all the men are wearing ankle length coats.
Well, we hadn't quite escaped.
Yeah, dresses didn't lift so much yet. Give it another 5 years and they'll start popping up.
Yeah.
Those hems will start shortening. Yeah. All I can think of, though, is Mary Poppins. But that's just me.
Oh, yes.
Since they have the whole suffragette movement song.
Uh-huh.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. And lots of very gorgeous gowns.
And I romanticize the whole thing. And this is also, you know, around the Titanic time. So mm-hmm. think about those for a visual for any listeners.
So I guess we do romanticize the Edwardian period. Because this is still Edwardian. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Late Edwardian. Sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's take what we've learned and see if we can make any predictions about the future of fashion. One of the things that's sticking with me that came up a minute ago was the role of gender in what's fashionable for people to wear.
Oh, yeah. And there's been a few news items lately about upcoming clothing lines or pop-up stores that incorporate a more unisex look.
Yeah. In January of this year, Selfridges in London actually did a pop-up unisex store where they offered everything from bathing suits to, like, you think it's very easy to sort of unisex things like tops, like a t-shirt is, you know, kind of carries across everyone, even though there are different cuts. Those are easy to kind of consider gender neutral, but they really have kind of been like, no, let's all wear the same swimsuit bottoms. Let's all wear the same, you know, kind of more body conscious styles. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. And you can see that on the street in the type of pants, for example, that men and women are wearing these days that are you know, for a certain body type, everyone is just wearing skinny leg tight jeans.
Well, and there are even, I mean, a bunch of different clothing stores and clothing lines that offer what's called the boyfriend jean.
Oh,
it's basically
course.
Boy cut jeans that are slightly altered for a woman's figure.
Yeah, for hips, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Boyfriend jeans.
I love watching the look on Joe's face as we discuss fashion. His eyes just get big at moments. They're
I'm
boyfriend
sorry,
jeans.
I think that's funny.
American Apparel has announced that in the fall they're going to be introducing a few gender-neutral pieces mm-hmm. in their very widespread stores. And, you know, historically, the trend of unisex clothing is nothing new.
No. I mean, it's happened periodically. Children, we'll go back in history for a minute briefly, but, you know, all children used to dress very similarly and very frilly. Like, I have a picture of my grandfather when he was a tiny child looking for all the world like the most dolly-dressed petite little girl mm-hmm. with the ringlets and everything.
To our standards, yeah.
That used to be very standard. Little boys would have on even dresses and these very frilly little ensembles up to a certain age.
Back then, did boys have to wear that until they'd killed a bear or something?
No, it was when they were quite little, yeah. you know. Then you sort of started to see the little boys' suits after a certain age.
Yeah, yeah. I think at like toddler age, again, with the practicality yeah. of like – if it's a baby, then it doesn't really matter to the baby. And also, it's just easier if it's in a gown, then.
Well, and two, within, you know, larger families, you just hand those off. You don't have to worry about, oh, no, we had a boy first or we had a girl first and now we have a boy. Just put the dress on him. It's fine.
Yeah. yeah.
Oh, I mean, one of the things I've always heard is that this whole idea of like blue being a color for boys and pink being a color for girls is a recent invention.
It is.
It was reversed, I believe, in
yeah,
the early part of the 19th century or 20th century, rather. And of course, over time, what's considered masculine and feminine for adults has varied so greatly across cultures and epochs and all of that kind of thing. Pants, for example. In the West, pant-type clothing became a gendered thing partially due to the rise of horseback infantry.
Huh.
And it wasn't until the rational dress movement of the mid-19th century that was an actual thing that happened. There were, like, pamphlets out like, you know, it's time for women to wear 7 pounds of underclothing or less. No more of this more than 10 pounds of underclothing. That trousers started to enter the scene for women, and they were considered so shocking at the time. Pants for women were high fashion around like 1911 and trendy amongst the populace by the 1930s or so.
Yes. And again, thank you, Paul Poiret.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but part of it also just seems to me to be changing attitudes about expecting people to dress or behave certain ways based on gender. Like, I think it used to be much more common to say, well, men should dress a certain way and
yes.
women should dress a certain way. And I think generally, our values are changing towards just not expecting people to do one or the other so much.
I hope so. That's lovely.
Yeah. And there have been, you know, sort of bursts of these moments in the past. I mean, when you look at sort of David Bowie in the Aladdin Sane phase, he brought in like a real trend of androgyny. Mm-hmm. That was pretty popular and fairly widespread because mm-hmm. he was, you know, a pop icon.
Yeah.
But again, it wasn't sort of enough of a groundswell to be like, this is how we do it now.
Yeah.
But it was sort of one of those early sputters that I think leads to moments like this where it's getting totally cool for things to be less gendered in terms of how they're made and cut and designed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's indicative of a like larger cultural shift of us, yeah, like redefining what gender roles and gender standards are, or even the concept of gender itself. Or you know, at the very least, we currently have a fascination with all of that, which you can see if you are, for example, on the internet ever by just looking at the, you know, huge fuss of MRAs decrying Fury Road because it had ladies in it, I guess. Or, you know, when Facebook exploded just this past week when we were recording this podcast with a Caitlyn Jenner's photo shoot, or just the sheer fact that teenagers on Tumblr frequently have in their public profiles not only their sexuality and their gender, but also their sex. They'll say, oh, I'm a cisgen dude, or I'm a trans lady, or whatever it is that they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, that dialogue is huge in the public sphere right now, mm-hmm. which is why fashion follows suit.
Yeah, I think this is hopefully just indicative of we're heading towards a world where people are just more cool with whatever anybody else wants to do.
Yeah, people know, can wear what they want. That's nice.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty easily applicable principle.
To quote RuPaul, you're all born naked, the rest is drag. Everybody
That's
is in
beautiful.
Everybody is in some form of drag because mm-hmm. it's all about presentation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard that before.
Really?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Probably aren't. Worshipping at the altar of Mama Ru the way that I do, but I'm like, really? I hear it every morning.
But that is interesting because you point out the whole thing about clothing being performative. Like when you put on an outfit, you are in a way enacting a performance. You're trying to mm-hmm. like present a certain face to the world. And that ties into something that comes up when we think about a lot of these sci-fi outfits that we were talking about earlier, which are these kind of like strange, really eye-catching or sort of high engagement elements, things that are not just like a plain piece of cloth, but they do something really active and strange or weird.
Yeah. I mean, I love this stuff. There have been a lot of these and a lot of different designers popping up kind of around these ideas that clothing should elicit responses and it should be responsive to the environment. There's a design company called Rainbow Winters, and they do – it's almost performance art. Like they have a dress that when it hears loud noises that could sound like peals of thunder, these lightning flashes will appear across the dress, and it's super beautiful.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Diana Eng, who is a designer that – some people may know if they watch Project Runway. She was the one that was a huge science geek that was on there. She has a clothing company, and she designs clothes that do similar things. They react to the environment and to exposure to light. And there's also a designer named Ying Gao, who really is often characterized more as a performance artist. Mm-hmm. But she makes these incredible clothes that have, like, these tiny little servos and stuff in them. And she has some that will react to being looked at. Like, they track eye movement, and they'll subtly shift, and it's very trippy looking when you look at some of them. Some of them just react to light, like if they're in a dark place and someone were to shine a flashlight on them, the fabrics will start to move and kind of flutter up together, and it's really beautiful, and it is very trippy. Like, there's this moment where you're like, am I watching something happen, or am I having a cerebral event? But it's all sort of designed to just kind of draw the viewer in and think about, like, what clothing is and what the presentation really is. I love it.
That's really interesting, but I want to revisit that in a question later in this episode about what people really want out of their clothing.
Okay. Sort of along those lines, I saw back in 2013 a Brazilian computer scientist named Katia Vega, who was demonstrating the system of false eyelashes that let you control technology. She had metallicized eyelashes and this conducive eyeshadow that when you blink or wink for more than half a second, it would complete this really low voltage circuit and let you control like a drone or light and unlight a crown of LEDs that you're wearing because you wear LED crowns sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's more along the lines of performance art at that point, but it's really interesting to me that designers are thinking about how to incorporate practicality into these fashion statements that we're making.
Mm-hmm. I just think about how many times things would be blinking because I'm a blinker anyway.
Well, she said that it was a hard blink, that it was, you know, it's the more than half a second is to make sure that your eyelashes fluttering isn't going to set off your
cell phone. I'm picturing all of the power on the block going out.
Yeah, but see, then you don't know if the person across the room is winking at you or just trying to activate their drone to,
right.
I don't know, steal something out of your dress.
Well, yeah, I guess if their drone comes over to you, then you know. And if it doesn't, then...
Ideally, you shouldn't be able to see
their drone. If you love a drone, wink it free. No, it doesn't quite work, but...
Of course, speaking of clothing and fashion items that activate electronics, that, of course, brings us to nanogenerators, which we've talked about before, but are worth mentioning again, the incorporation into clothing of ways of generating power.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of work on this going on very near to us at Georgia Tech. Dr. Z.L. Wang has a lab there, has really advanced nanogenerators quite a bit. And they're not just for textiles. You can also incorporate them. Like, there are some that are intended as medical devices that will be self-powering where the movement of your body, for example, like your lungs breathing will flex the nanogenerator enough to generate a current, potentially like run a pacemaker.
Your heart beating will run your
but
pacemaker.
But, of course, it also gets incorporated. They did not seem to come to fruition, and I don't remember the company, but for a while you were seeing, like, in those little mini look for this in the future kind of blurbs in fitness magazines, like, oh, there's a company working on putting nanogenerators into, like, running pants, and eventually they will power your iPod or your, you know, shuffle, and then you will have to keep running to keep getting music. And it's a great concept, but it doesn't seem to have taken off because it's been a couple years since those were really kind of popping up everywhere.
Yeah, I remember hearing about this too. I mean, I think generally the idea was that you would have piezoelectric elements that, like, when you smash them or press them, apply pressure, it sends a current to something. But you couldn't ever get that much current out of it with the kinds of motions that a human body produces.
It was a break in the level of current that you could get out of the things without storing, like, a heavy battery upon your person.
Yeah, like, a few years ago, I'm sure it's advanced since then, but that was when I was working on a project for work here for it, and it was like you could get about 2 A batteries worth of power from, you know, a pretty decent amount of. Now, my theory is just slap those on a bunch of kindergartners and let them go, and that's a lot of A batteries. We can power the world, but
or a dog, you know, a dog.
Oh, yeah.
Pooches.
Frantic cats. Yeah.
It seems like nanogenerators have kind of been supplanted in terms of what's the next big thing in technology clothing with solar systems. There's a company called Wearable Solar that makes clothes that have solar panels on them.
I bet that looks super cool.
You know, I have to say that's really the sticking point, is that the actual designs are a little – they're doing some pretty interesting things, and they're really working to finesse them, and they're improving all the time. But they still look a little like something out of THX1138. You know, they're a little clunky monkey. And there's another company which is called Voltaic Systems, and they actually make bags that will similarly collect solar energy and create power with it. Right now, the bags are all very utility. They're not super fashion-y, but give it a minute. That's an easy to adapt situation.
Yeah, I remember some backpacks coming out maybe about 5 years ago or so that I saw that were, had little solar panels built in.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, but also there is the question of the materials that we make our clothing out of and how our clothes are manufactured and how this does actually become a part of the fashion, because the material in a lot of ways is the fashion element, right? I mean, material matters.
Part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's material and construction follows the material, so.
I saw something that I thought was really interesting. It was actually a feature in a new item that was being inducted into the Museum of Modern Art, which was a, quote, 4D dress.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not a size, I had to realize, but that refers to 4D printing. So that's a concept we've talked about on this show before. But the idea is 3D printed materials that change over time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Due to some kind of stimulus.
Right. So the traditional one is, say, you print out a flat sheet that's sort of like a cross shape, and then you put it in water or you shake it or you do something that applies some kind of like changing force on it, and along some pre-printed hinges, it will fold up into a cube. Pretty standard.
Who doesn't need that?
Right. A cube, yeah.
I mean, I
wish I had more cubes in my house because I'm always trying to solve the Lament configuration. And if I could just put some decoy cubes that would keep me away from the real danger. But anyway... there were some people from a design studio called Nervous System, and they designed a kinematic dress created using this 4D printing principle. So it's 3D printed materials that adapt over time to make a dress. Well, what would that mean? So normally you would have to make clothes by stitching together flat pieces of fabric or material, but this was one piece printed in a 3D printer. So it's printed in sort of this jumbled up ball. And it's a custom body-fitted 3D dress that's made from a digital 3D scan of the body of the person who's going to be wearing it. And it's a dress made out of 2,279, quote, unique triangular panels. I love that. It's a great triangular panel. So each of these little panels is going to be rigid. but they make the dress fabric-y, I guess. They make it flexible when they connect at these hinges. And so you can watch a video of this online if you want to look it up. Tons of hinges, little triangles. It makes something that just looks like a dress.
It
looks
so it behaves like a knit.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I think that's really interesting, the idea that you could print your clothes in the future. Like, you could go straight from a digital design to a print to something that you could wear. So sort of imagine a future where instead of trying on clothes at the store, you scan your body. I guess you'd have to get naked at the store to scan it. Or maybe you got one of these at home. I don't know. Yeah. You scan your body, and then the computer comes up with the piece of clothing that is a perfect fit for you. You can make alterations to it in your little Photoshop-style clothing editor, and then you print it, and then you can wear it.
And then everything will have Greedo on it.
Right.
In my future. Now I have to do it the chump way, where I have to actually design fabric and order it to be printed and then make a thing out of it. This will really save me steps.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, future.
I hope so. Now, of course, this is right now, this is a kind of like intensive and expensive process. That's why you see it's coming out of like a design studio and not like a store that's just making tons of these to sell people. But I can imagine like the price and the intensivity of the design stage coming down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
Intensivity?
Sure. It's a word now.
We'll pretend it's a word.
Yeah.
Whether or not
you
it is.
You coined it, champ.
We are the music makers and we are the dreamers of the dreams.
Yeah.
Other fabrics that might be made in the future include organic ones and not like cotton.
No, there is actually a company called BioCouture, and they have figured out this way to grow fabric from basically like a sugar green tea water solution with a mother culture of bacteria. This basically grows a piece of fabric that
not
can
like,
then be like laser cut and turned into clothes.
Right, not Whoa. A thread that has to be woven.
Correct.
Right.
It's pretty fascinating. And wow. Right now it's in early stages. One of the things, there is a great documentary. I was actually watching it right before we came in here, so I didn't even add it to the notes. It's called The Next Black. And they talk with a lot of different people that are, you know, sort of shaping the future of fashion. But this woman behind BioCouture was saying, like, right now it's still in its infancy and it's very simple. But what she envisions for the future is that eventually they could genetically engineer the bacteria to be able to produce different kinds of fabric
Ooh.
And different thicknesses and
oh,
different
man.
With different qualities. And then it will just become a huge thing. And the really great thing is that there's almost no waste to things like this. Because you can just reintegrate whatever your cutout pieces are. You can either biodegrade them or you can potentially reintegrate them as perhaps a mother culture, depending on its status at that point.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great. You no more like beautiful scraps of fabric
Correct.
That you have no use for.
You can always find a use.
Oh, yeah. Well,
if it's bigger than a 4x4-inch piece, you can find a use for it.
There are always handbags to be made.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. It's true. Well, I wanted to talk for a minute about the fashion of hiding, about using fashion for digital camouflage.
So are you talking about fashion that's just designed to blend in with the crowd so that you're the opposite of a character in The Fifth Element? You're just kind of
And you're more like a character in a William Gibson novel.
Sure, yeah.
There you go. No, but that is certainly a thing that I could see people doing and that people frequently do. Like the fashion of just blending in and being ignored.
It's what I go for. My main fashion thing is, like, is this not going to be noticeably ugly?
Aw.
I don't always succeed, but...
No. When that facial recognition boom hit in 2013, coinciding with the leak of the NSA's sort of best practices that everyone started freaking out about with completely good reason, a few concepts surrounding this fashion of digital camouflage surfaced. And that's fashion that will let you hide from facial recognition technology. For example, there's one project called CV Dazzle that released a kind of lookbook of tips for fashionable techno camouflage. They were inspired by the cubism designs of World War I naval camouflage,
mm-hmm.
which are fascinating unto themselves. And And also the understanding that, that facial recognition software depends on IDing key facial features and symmetry and comparative tones across the contours of any given face. That means the kind of highlighting and shadows that are created by the bridge of the nose and cheekbones and the brow across most humans. Yeah?
Yeah.
So their idea was to arrange your hair in ways that obscure part of your face and to use makeup to disrupt those lines of your contours, your cheekbones, your nose bridge, your brow. And, you know, you kind of get bonus points for creating designs that mimic eyes elsewhere on your face that will totally freak out the software. And the designs really wound up looking like a street punk version of Gem and the Holograms. It was not what I'd call practical for day wear, necessarily. It was something like at a Transmet, if you guys have read the comic book Transmetropolitan. But, I mean, it was interesting looking.
I just thought you meant the restaurant in Athens.
Oh. There's a restaurant in Athens called Transmet?
It is. Named after the book.
Oh, okay.
To the best of my knowledge, it is.
I'm not sure if I would want to eat at a place.
It's yummy. Go there. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
Can you just go Furiosa and just engine grease the top half of your face?
I think we all should be
that's
more
not
like
for
Furiosa.
Me. I mean, I love her, but that look is not for me.
Oh, well, she pulls it off.
I'll do something else, but not so much with that one.
Not the engine grease, maybe?
Yeah,
bad for the skin.
That's interesting. It makes me wonder, though, is trying to hide from cameras a fashion statement? I guess it kind of is. You know?
Well, I think if you do something like this, you make it one.
Yeah. So it's not just the practical aspect of, like, I don't want facial recognition software to key me in and put me in a database somewhere. It's that you're actually saying, like, I'm not the kind of person who wants to be recognized. This is who I am. This is my fashion statement.
This is a visual representation of myself, and that is slightly paranoid with good reason. Yeah.
But with glittery shadow and makeup.
Yeah. With beautiful, bright colors and very strange fringe styles.
It's the magical combination of peacocking and hiding at the same time.
Right, which is what I found so great about it. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, high fashion hiding. Another thing along those lines, Japan's National Institute of Informatics released this pair of goggles that will hypothetically block your face on infrared sensitive cameras due to them having these very bright outward shining LEDs that were in the near infrared range. So you're not going to give your coworkers headaches wearing them, but cameras will be blinded by them as long as they pick up the infrared.
Crazy.
Yeah. I've not seen anyone wearing them. I don't think they really caught on.
Wow.
mostly because a lot of cameras are visual range and not infrared range.
Yeah.
But, you know, for certain uses, I could see how they could be, you know, terrific. Another thing that I guess we might be moving towards, but that I have not seen catch on with anyone yet. What if fashion becomes deemed unnecessary? What if clothes don't need to exist anymore in the future?
Oh, well, so you're going like full on beyond just the jumpsuits future into like why wear clothing at all?
Yeah.
Well, that is actually an interesting idea, I think, because if you think about the history of clothes, in addition to being purely decorative and sort of fashionable or expressive of your personality, clothing has had, you know, at least a largely functional origin. Like, it protects you from cold, trapping body heat. Protects you from the elements, so rain and snow and sleet and all that. Protects you from insects and mosquito bites. Protects your skin from the sun. In some cases, it'll actually protect you from mechanical damage, so you can see like a lot of leather armor, basically.
Sure.
And then, of course, there's the protection of our sensibilities, the idea that we think like nudity is socially inappropriate. But I was just thinking about how a lot of people these days live in climate-controlled, sheltered, mostly bug-free environments and spend like 95% of their time there. So if you are a person who lives a life like that where almost all of your existence is in a place where you don't need to be protected from cold, rain, sleet, sun, insects, snake bites, saddle sores, stuff like that, will we eventually select for nudity? Like, is there any reason people will continue to want to wear clothes?
Well, one question, will we continue to keep pets?
Hmm.
Because, you know, just a piece of fabric will help a lot from a cat walking on you and accidentally giving you a claw mark.
But if we become the equivalent of an indoor cat.
But if we're still also keeping indoor cats. Yeah. But I want to say no just because I like clothes so much.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, are we living on the axiom? Like, I don't know where we land at that point.
Well, I had a kind of stupid idea, but my thought was, you know, this would make chairs difficult. Because, like, I wouldn't want to, you know, if I lived in a world where everybody was naked all the time, I wouldn't want to, like, have public use chairs where I put my butt, my naked butt on some chair that somebody else's butt has been on.
I mean, I barely want to sit on the subway train to begin with, like, with multiple layers between my butt and the previous person's butt. So, yeah. I think.
But maybe in the future there will be nudity, but all chairs will have like the chair equivalent of the toilet seat cover at the airport.
Well, or they'll all be made with antimicrobial materials. So yeah.
Oh, there
you go.
They'll
sort of be self-cleaning.
Yeah.
But no.
No.
I think
clothes.
The sensibilities will override a lot of it anyway. And
mm-hmm.
two, if you take away the clothes, there's a whole cultural thing then of like people will have to actually be humans and have conversations and cultivate personalities.
Oh man, that
sounds... I'm a clothes person. I love it, but I think if you take all the clothes away, it will become very, very difficult to talk to one another.
Yeah. Also, man, like that would erase so many like class lines and gender lines. I mean, that would.
And a lot of people are not going to want to let those go.
Not. No. Huh. Good question though.
I mean, I can't imagine being comfortable being.
I mean, there are nudist colonies and have been for a long time.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
But
not for everyone.
Yeah, those are definitely a niche and not the pervasive cultural norm.
Okay, well, here's another sort of question for discussion then. And it's about the idea of these sort of like what we were talking about with these high engagement pieces of clothing and sort of e-clothes. So we've talked about wearables, e-clothing, and I think it's a very simple proposition these days to create textiles or clothing items that have some form of embedded electronics or some kind of reactive visible feature. But most of our discussion in the past has sort of been about functionality, like, you know, clothes that are self-cleaning or gathering data or displaying data for you, or, you know, it might be fitness data or health data. But what about simple fashion? Like, do you think in the future many people will actually want to wear clothing with embedded electronic elements, like these clothes we see with LED lights and screens and displays embedded in them, just for aesthetic reasons? Or is that going to remain the kind of thing that it is today, where it's just kind of like a weird novelty or curiosity? I mean, would people actually want screens and lights and stuff in the clothes they wear every day?
Yeah, if I wouldn't get the number of weird looks that I know that I would be wearing a tutu like studded with LED lights right now.
I don't care about weird looks, but they're hard to wash.
Yeah.
That's the trick,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
most
yeah.
of the
they're hard
garments
to
that have
construct,
that stuff.
And they're hard to wash.
They're not that hard to construct. Like, there are a lot of groups now that, you know, online groups that'll do, like,
Sure.
Here's LED clothing that we're incorporating, but it's the washability that makes it tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you go to a tech convention today, you're going to see tons of this stuff.
Are you kidding? If you go to a nighttime race.
Yeah.
There are a million people wearing tutus with lights in them.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're saying, like, just the practical factor of the washability. Well, okay, let's eliminate that. Let's say it's just as washable as your standard piece of clothing.
I would be wearing it right now.
That you think people really do want that for standard clothing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a concept of flashiness, literally, I suppose, that it sounds like for you it would be a foreign concept. Like, you're trying not to attract attention with your clothing.
Yeah,
but
it seemed ridiculous to me, but I don't know. I mean,
so pretty,
I can't
though.
Imagine wanting to have elements on my clothing that would, like, make people look at me.
I don't care if people look at me or not. I just care if I'm delighted.
Yeah.
And here's the magic words. And this is why Diana Ang always stays a designer that I love. She knows the magic word to get me to go, I want that. And it's twinkle. She'll be like, this is the twinkle collection. I'm like, shut up and take my money. I wish to have twinkle clothes. Thank you. Thank you. It's you're walking glitter at that point. Who doesn't want that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a.
Not everybody is Tinkerbell.
Well, I'm not Tinkerbell either, but I almost, there's a part of me, I'm holding back from going down a Disney fairies tangent road with just a galloping vengeance.
I appreciate it. I think we all do. Thank you, Holly. We know you're one of the other fairies. We get it.
You know, Holly, I think we should plumb your expertise on another question, a question that actually came from a user.
Oh, yeah. A listener, in fact, at Rosie Phillip via Twitter asked, will cravats ever make a comeback?
Lauren, I know you've done some research on this.
Okay. So I looked into it, and the necktie really is a descendant of the cravat. So it's basically never gone out, really. But the cravat was supposedly originated by Croatian militia circa the 1600s, then popularized by French fashion. They're called cravats because the French word for the Croatian militia was basically cravat, or cravat, rather. But it then bled over into British fashion and thus, to use the parlance of our times, went viral.
Can I stop you and ask a question?
Of course.
I'm sorry. So I know what a necktie is. A cravat is basically just like a more loosely tied, less shaped kind of necktie thing.
You're onto it with the less structure, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's loosely tied. If you look at French cravats, sometimes they would be wrapped multiple times and tied fairly tightly around the neck. Sometimes they're tied a little more loosely, but they're just not the structure that you would get from a bow tie or a necktie.
Oh man, I just looked it up.
but a cravat, is basically a scarf that is tied about the neck in whatever fashion the user intends to tie it in. There is a cravat day in Croatia as of 2003. It's October 18th of every year. Let's celebrate it, guys.
I'm in.
For that first one, there was an art installation of a gargantuan red necktie knotted around a local arena.
It was tied around this Colosseum.
Yeah.
Coming out the side of it.
Wearing a cravat.
Yeah, it was beautiful. But Holly, what's your opinion on the fashion statement of cravats?
They're already back.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, last year, Nicholas Parsons, who is a British personality, he's kind of a TV hosty kind of personality, he's been around a very long time, but he wrote this whole thing last year about cravats are back, everybody. I have said so. So start wearing them. But also, Fred from Scooby-Doo is the famous cravat wearer.
Ooh, that's true.
But, yeah. Some people have argued it's a neckerchief. It's a cravat, in my opinion.
It is.
Here's a picture of Brad Pitt wearing a cravat.
Yeah, they're very zazzy.
And I think Eli Roth is standing right behind him.
All right.
So if it makes Eli Roth follow you.
And I think that the popularity of British period dramas, for example, have probably influenced that, just Benedict Cumberbatch's existence, and et cetera.
I think, I'm very into clothing freedom. Wear whatever you want, whenever you want. I don't care if it's in fashion or not. If it's making you happy,
do it.
You're living it and it's cool.
Yeah.
Get your life, to use another RuPaul thing. So I think nothing ever completely goes out of fashion unless you decide that you don't want to wear it. And then it's out of your fashion. And there are certainly cultural fashion trends, but everything's on the table, in my opinion, at all times. I'm going to wear a bustle gown tomorrow.
Yes.
Wow.
Not all really, right. But they're hard to drive in.
I'd imagine.
So what are the takeaways for the future of fashion from the people who know what they're talking about here? I feel like I heard more acceptance of basically more freedom and less expectance that you would wear a certain thing based on what your culture is or what your gender is or something like that. More freedom. More individuality, and that probably translating to more androgyny in fashion. Lots of these electronic elements that, as long as we can get past the washing machine barrier, which somehow I feel like can be beaten, we can get there. You're saying you're pro electronics.
Yeah,
of course.
Okay.
Yeah, why not? Electronics and everything.
4D printed clothing, strange biocultured fabrics. What else? Camouflage.
I don't know if digital camouflage will ever really become an actual trend. I'm doubtful, personally.
I think it will become probably popular in a less peacocky way in a niche market.
Yeah. Certainly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think there is a group of people out there who's like, I need that.
Yeah.
Because they just don't like the idea of the, pervasive all-seeing eye everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to evolve. It'll be less about kind of the showy Gem and the Holograms makeup, mm-hmm. and more there will be other ways that people will develop to get around it.
Probably more along the lines of those goggles, technologies that you can use to counteract technologies.
What else? Yes to cravats, no to nudity.
You wear only the cravat. That's all. You're technically not nude.
Like kind of togas that are made out of just one giant cravat, perhaps?
No, that's a different
for men
thing.
And women?
Cravat's just for necks.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I hope that it will be more of an anything goes kind of future in fashion, and that more types of fabrics and more choices will become more affordable due to some of these technologies that are letting us create fabric in these ways. And hopefully fewer sweatshops. That would be really great as well. All right.
Well, Holly, it has been excellent having you on the show with us today. Thank you so much for coming. And where can people find your work?
First, thank you for having me. But if they want to chase us over to Mist in History, you can go to mistinhistory.com. And you can hit us at Twitter, @MistInHistory. And we're on Facebook, facebook.com/MistInHistory.
Awesome.
Lauren, where can people find our work?
Well, Joe, it's on the internet. You can check out our website. It is fwthinking.com. If you would like to ask us a question the way that @RosiePhillip did, you can do so on Twitter, @FWThinking, on Facebook, and at Google+. FWThinking is basically the name in all of those places. You can also send us an email at fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. We hope to hear from you, and you'll hear again from us real soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.